So they always say you lost, like in my case, they say 23 years. That's not true. I lost my whole life. Because everything I was, accomplished, and had done, people I'd loved before that, they're all gone.
That's the voice of Bill Richards. On August 10th, 1993, he came home from a typical day's work to discover his wife, Pamela, had been brutally murdered. That's also when he was first arrested. But Bill was completely innocent of the crime and would not taste freedom again until May 26th, 2016. He rode his motorbike down to San Diego this morning to talk with me about what went wrong in his case and how he is now making up for lost time.
I grew up in South Chicago, south side of Chicago. My father was an electronic engineer, worked for the Department of Defense, and my mother had a doctorate in nursing. And she taught mostly at universities, nursing, did work somewhat in hospitals. Normal childhood, nothing really eventful. Used to build things, build go-karts, build mini bikes. Obviously I like motorcycles. Eventually I wanted to open up my own engineering company. So I was preparing for that, while working for big companies. I made a decent income. The old 9-to-5 job. Well, actually, it wasn't, because when you got a major project going, you might work 12 hours a day. I was just about to get most of it going. We were building the house in the country, and that's where my wife died. And I was going to set up a facility there, because I had 5 acres, where I was going to have millwrights come in, piecework, and start my engineering company.
So, if we go back a bit, can you tell me about meeting your wife?
Well, that was kind of funny, because I was actually dating her cousin. And her cousin kept talking and stuff about marriage and stuff. And I said, whoa. Yeah, I didn't feel that way about her. So one day she said, she came over to my apartment, and she said, let's go visit my cousin Pammy. And we walked in her cousin Pammy's door, and that was it. Pam later told me that the minute she saw me, she knew I was going to be her husband. Isn't that crazy? We dated steady for about 2 years, and then eventually got married. But yeah, it was a nice family wedding. The way they used to do it back east, married in her church, and had a reception at the house, all the family from both sides and all that. Yeah, it was nice. It was real nice. Found her dress. The year we got married, the style of wedding dresses looked like a nurse's uniform. And we looked around for days and finally found one that she called it her Gone with the Wind dress. It was layer after layer of tier of lace with a long train. So she was real happy about that. It was a normal day. I was going in at 3, I think I started, because I know I left around 2. I was kind of doing, under California laws, you had to have somebody from the engineering department in the facility at all times. So we took turns doing this rotating thing instead of our regular jobs. And it was my last day doing this. So we got up in the morning. We talked for about an hour. And we went out, had some breakfast, picked up some things for my lunch, came home, she hugged me, and I went to work. I never expected, what I found that night. We actually had plans what we were going to do when I got home, so obviously it didn't happen. First thing I noticed coming in was that the lights were out, and Pam was night blind. So I thought she went to bed, which was odd because we had plans. And I got up on the property, and we're building a house. We had electricity, but being Mr. Honest, I didn't hook up to it because the house wasn't up yet, the regulations. So we had a generator running, and we're staying in our motorhome. And so I walked in, there's a storage building. I think I got a drink of iced tea. I just thought she was in bed asleep. And then when I came out and I turned the light on inside the shed, and I don't know if that's what helped me see her or my eyes just adjusted to the headlights being out, but I saw her laying there in the yard. So course, I ran over to her. But that was rather surprising. Pretty much, I picked her up. As best I can remember, I just picked her up and had her, held her in my lap, because there's no question. I'm not going to describe the damage, but there's no question she was dead. And I didn't know what had happened yet. I figured maybe she had fallen, because, you know, it's a construction zone. There's like cinder blocks and stuff around. There was one by her head. And so I thought she had fallen. I called 911. And then realized that the police wouldn't find the place in a country like that with no lights, so I went to start the generator. When I went back behind the building where the generator is, like a little containment for it, I saw her pants and blood and a shoe. So that's when I realized she'd been attacked. Oh, it took over 30 minutes for a patrolman to arrive. He just stood there and, you know, basically he called in that, yes, there was a body, and that was it.
And then was it like at around 3 that the homicide unit actually turned up?
Yes, yeah, they showed up around 3. And they just walked right in past me. They walked up to the body, started looking around, and I thought it was appalling. There's one was smoking and dropping cigarette butts, contaminating the crime scene. And they all kept looking at me, you know, like, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm a victim here. But they didn't see it that way. They had already made up their minds. And then they took me down to a police station. So That night, yeah. I was probably gone by 3:30 or 4 off the property. So it's absolutely appalling. At the time, I didn't know this, but as it came out, they didn't take fingerprints or bloody handprints on the side of the motorhome, which was fiberglass. It was smooth. You could take, I guess, there's blood and evidence all over inside the motorhome. There are rocks that she was hit with that were smooth that could have fingerprinted. They didn't take temperatures at time of death. They did nothing. They took a few photographs, sat around smoking, drinking coffee, and left. And they didn't even allow the coroner's investigator to examine the body. He wasn't called for several hours after they were there. And like he said, that's his job, is to examine the body. And they never let him do that. They just let him transport it around noon the next day. So, yeah, terrible investigation. So all the evidence he would have collected with his scientific training, we didn't get. And without them doing DNA testing and fingerprinting, we're still, you know, me personally and my civil attorneys are trying to find out who did this, but there's so little to work with because they didn't do their job, you know.
And do you think that's just because they thought it was you straight away?
I think that's just how they do it. They just picked a suspect and said he's going to be the one, because they ignored the fact that they knew I'd been at work. They ignored obvious. I mean, you don't need to be a pathologist to see that she'd been dead a long time. There were just so many things to say, I couldn't have done this, and I think they just ignored it. What did Toffler call it? Cognitive dissonance. We just don't accept information that doesn't agree with your preconceived idea. And that's what they did. They just said, okay, he's guilty. We don't need to collect evidence. We got him at the crime scene. And they did get a conviction out of it. It took them 5 years and 4 tries, but they did, you know. They had me down there a couple times, probably better than 15 hours of grilling each time. And you realize the night my wife died, by the time I'd seen them, I'd already been up for 16 hours. By the time they let me go, I'd probably been awake close to 32 hours. And hadn't eaten in at least 24. So they get your blood sugar low and they get you tired, and then they play what were standard brainwashing techniques. They kept telling you what they wanted to hear. And then they'd leave you alone, let your mind go, and then they'd come back and do it again. And they kept trying to get me to confess and say something they could use. And I knew what they were doing. It was obvious. Even in my mental state, which was pretty bad, I still knew what they were doing. It's like, come on, you know. And I actually thought they would eventually do their job. I told them at one point, I know you always go after a spouse or a family member, but when you do your job, you'll find out. Well, they never did their job.
Did you trust that they would?
No, not within 2 to 3 days after she died. Like I say, I've been through a lot of things in my life, but nothing hooked me like Pam. When Pam died and I found her like that, nothing ever upset me like that. But it was real obvious that they weren't doing their job. I actually started looking around myself with some friends, the neighborhood, trying to figure out, because we did have a lot of problem with people getting off the trains and stuff close by, and there had been a lot of crime, mostly caused by these people. They get off the trains, rob a house, do something, and get back on the train, and then they're gone, they're ghosts. And so we started looking around, but then they arrested me after the funeral. At least I got to go to the funeral, and that was it. Never got out again until 2016.
Three attempts to convict Bill had failed for various reasons. When it came to the fourth trial, the prosecution were determined to bring their case to a close. That's where they introduced their bite mark expert. Pamela's body had a distinct bite mark on it, and the prosecution's expert would stand up in court and testify to near certainty that this mark could only have been left by Bill Richards. That testimony was wrong, but it would be years before the same expert would recant his evidence, evidence that was pivotal to obtaining the jury's guilty verdict.
I was the one kept talking about the bite mark evidence. I kept trying to get it in because I knew it would clear me. And I'd seen it at her funeral because of the damage. It was a closed casket, but they covered up her face and all I could hold was her hand. And when I held her hand, I saw this very clear, distinct bite mark. It didn't look anything like the picture they used in court. It was very clear rectangles, dark bluish black bruising. Because I would not have recognized what they used in court. So
you actually tried to get this evidence in?
Yes, I was the one who kept bringing it in because I said, well, look, it's not me, I didn't do this. I didn't realize how bogus bite testimony was at that time. I didn't learn that till, you know, this guy came in and said, oh yeah, that's me. I mean, this guy could sell ice to an Eskimo. He was a hell of a salesman. But when you compared my bite on a computer, my bite's better than 3/8 of an inch bigger, so I couldn't make that wound. The teeth don't align, and I believe the killer was missing several teeth that I have. So just looking at the thing myself, but it was clearly impossible for me to make that bite. But I didn't have that option going into trial, so that was all post-conviction.
He said, I want to get a picture of how certain he was. So he said it was like, was it 1-2% of the population?
He said 2% of the population. And it's kind of funny because since then I've talked to several people who have the same abnormality. And he insisted that tooth would not leave a mark. And it bites deeper than the others because it's in front of the others. And he knew that. But no, he got into court. And this I can say because it was public. Jordan Smith for The Intercept did an article on him, where he bragged that he came in to save the day. He was going to be the white knight on the horse. And he said they tried to convict me several times. And so he was going to be the one to show that was my bite. But it wasn't. And yet he told the jury it was, within certainty of 2%. So, which of course, there's no scientific evidence of that effect either. There's blue fibers under a crack in her fingernail that they showed pictures of to the jury. And they said it matched my shirt. Well, the problem with that is pictures at the autopsy, while the fingers are still attached, there's no fibers, and it's not even a crack in the fingernail. So clearly these arrived after they severed two of the fingers and sent them to this one criminalist, and he turned around and produced finding these fibers. Another criminalist had already gone under the fingernails at the autopsy and removed all trace evidence. And so they sent it to him, and he suddenly finds a crack with fibers. So that's pretty clear. They didn't magically appear, you know. She'd broken off fingernails. She had acrylic nails, so they were strong. And she broke off fingernails, clawing and fighting her attacker. She had numerous, I think they couldn't count all the bruises on her forearms from blocking blows. I think it's like over 20 on one arm. And you don't hit somebody without injuring yourself. I mean, it's simple physics. It's equal pressure between two sides. If you hit somebody, your hand hurts because it took the same blow as whoever you hit. And so I have no bruising, no scratches, nothing indicating I was the one that inflicted any of these injuries.
And at trial, how's it? I want to get a sense of that kind of emotional feeling of being so helpless, because you're listening to this guy saying it's definitely you. What's that like?
I can't even describe that. It's like you're in the bottom of a well, you know? It's like, why can't I get the truth across? Because all these lies, all these distortions, this guy's up there saying this is my bite, and I looked at the pictures, it doesn't look anything like my bite. But the jury believes whatever the police expert tells them. And DA gets up there and says, you have to believe him, he's the good guy. Well, he's not, he's a liar, he's a fraud. But nonetheless, they believed him. And it's just such a sinking feeling that you just want to scream, why can't I get the truth across? It's here. And yet nobody would listen to it, and I couldn't find a lawyer that would stand up and defend me. The first two lawyers, I had enough money to hire a lawyer, but they've got tricks. They froze my assets. I probably had a couple $100,000 equity in the property. I could have hired a lawyer. They froze my assets before they arrested me. And so now I had to go to court with a public defender. And while he was a very good lawyer, but he was on a leash. He would not call them liars. He would not stand up with the evidence he had saying, look, you're lying. He couldn't do that. And the last lawyer I went to court with was even worse than that. He did no defense whatsoever. So when the guy was up there saying, this is my bite, and I'm insisting, well, look, let me bite my hand and show it to the jury. This tooth leaves a mark. He's saying it doesn't, because it's not on my wife. And he wouldn't let me do it. I went through all kinds of fights with him and the judge. Judge wouldn't let me fire him. So it's a hopeless feeling. You just, helpless and hopeless. You just don't know what to do, you know?
Did your wife's family and your family stick by you at this point? Did they believe you?
Oh, yes, everything. Matter of fact, I have declarations and letters from my wife's sister. They were very close. They spent a lot of time on the phone and what have you. She flew out. The police kept them off the stand pretty much. But her sister came out, and at closing sentencing, the family has a right to speak by law. And that's where they usually get up there and say, hang the bastard forever. But in turn, she attacked the DA and told him, this is all lies, this is wrong, this didn't happen, you know. So there's a lot of support on record from her family. And of course, my family stood by me, but, you know, her family is what's really important, the fact that they stood by me. And I still have, I'm in contact with my wife's best friend that she grew up with, and she says the same thing. There's no way I believe in any of that stuff. So,
talk to me about that feeling when the jury come forward after four trials. This is the fourth trial now.
Yeah.
They come forward and say, "We, the jury of the state of California, find William Richards guilty of murder." Tell me about that.
Well, it's kind of funny. By that time, I was almost numb. You know, I just looked at it and I thought, because I feel myself. It's like falling out of an airplane without a parachute. You know you're going to die. You see it coming. You just watch it coming at you. And no matter what you try to do, you can't flap your arms hard enough, you know? No matter what I tried to do to get the truth up there, it just didn't come out. And so I think by the time they found me guilty, I was numb. Well, I was in custody from September 3rd, 1993, but it took them 5 years to get me there. County jail is far worse than prison, you know. So when I got to prison, I would have been around 99, 2000, somewhere like that. And of course, I went straight to a level 4 yard, you know, which is the hardcore yards, because I was in for murder. So I had to learn and adapt and survive, you know, especially if you're if you're not affiliated, if you're not a gang member or anything like that, it's a rough road when you're on your own, you know.
And did you find a group that you attached yourself to in that?
No, never did. I would look for people to hang out with that were pretty much like me. Even if they were guilty of the crime, they'd live a normal life. They didn't live a criminal life. You know, it's one guy I knew, he'd actually killed somebody. Actually, I know a couple of people like that had actually killed somebody, but they were normal people before that. And they were easier to hang out with and talk to than the people who sold drugs and gangbangers. And so I did my best to avoid them, you know. I was working in a repair shop on level 4 yard at Sentinella Prison. And there's a fellow in there with me who I was talking to, and he was innocent. And I've seen his paperwork, I have no doubt, but he gave me the address and phone number for the CIP, and that had to be around 2000. And he gave me the information, and I wrote them, and they sent me back a questionnaire, which I sent to an attorney who was kind of handling my appeal, and never heard anything back. So I wrote again, and they sent another thing, and anyway, then we got it all worked out. And then by that time, I think it was Kim Hernandez, who used to work there at the CIP, and Noel Van Devers was the intern, and her later husband, Derek Van Devers. They were the two students who picked up the case, working with Kim to get it picked up. I was elated to find somebody who actually did this kind of work, because I'd never heard of it. Yeah, I'd never been involved in a criminal system. I didn't know anything about it. And I was just totally elated that these people were going to look at it. I thought, oh, a couple of years, this will be over, I'll be out, because the evidence was so clear. But of course, it took 16 years. But it's not for their lack of trying. They tried hard, they did everything right, went through numerous, God, 16 interns, I guess, and several different lawyers. I think Nancy Rosenfeld was the first, then Wendy Cohen, and then Alyssa, Alyssa Bjorkel. Those three went through it from beginning to end, and it finally happened.
So this expert that gives evidence in your trial to convict you eventually goes back on what he says, right?
Yes, he did. He recanted. There were three other odontologists who had done the computer comparisons, which weren't being used at the time, you know. So computers come a long way. And they all found that, of course, it was impossible for that to be my bite. And when they talked to him and discussed it with him, it took some convincing, but he did come in and recant and say, well, I just eyeballed the case. You know, it's all he did. So he didn't use computers, he didn't use measurement devices. He just, yep, looks close to me, but he wanted to be the hero, you know.
The one thing that I found incredible about reading it is not only does he say I was wrong, he says that it categorically can't be your...
Yes, he did. Yeah, he said the same thing. When he saw the computer comparisons and corrected image, he did. He said, impossible, it can't be mine. So, which is what I was hoping he would have said in the trial, you know, but that's not the way it worked out.
So then, take me to that day when the judge in 2009, is it?
Yes.
He overturns your conviction. What does he say?
It's kind of funny because they did their closing arguments and the DA did what they always do. He got up there and tried to tell them you didn't see what you saw, you didn't hear what you heard, you know, like they do with juries, try to confuse them. And he looked at him and says, I did hear the testimony, I did see the evidence, you know. And then he picked up a paper head and he made a ruling, he had it typed out already, that basically said, taking all the information, all the evidence combined, putting it together, not one single piece, but all of it together, showed that the evidence pointed unerringly to innocence. And unfortunately, I never got home, but he tried. So.
So you were there in court. He says you are innocent.
Yes.
And then it's 7 more years.
Yeah, 7 more years. Yeah. When he read that paper, I was tasting pizza. I thought I'm going home tonight. And that didn't happen. And all through the evidentiary hearing, which was dragged out for months, it was only supposed to be 3 days, they kept offering me deals, time served, you know, that way they get away with a conviction. And like they do with a lot of exonerees, a lot of times they have to take those deals. And it doesn't mean they're not innocent, it just means they're just tired of fighting and stuff. But I'm stubborn, and I said, no, we're going for broke. And when the judge ruled unerringly to innocence, I thought I was going home, because I didn't know it would take so much time, you know. I still would never have taken a deal, though. So when the one ruling came back, which I thought was the last one, that the testimony of these experts can't be considered, I went back to my cell and said, okay, I'm going to die in prison. And started, that was the first time I'd ever given up, and said, well, it's the highest court said, doesn't matter what the evidence says, I'm not going home. So at that point, I gave up. And then it came back with the changed law.
Judge McCarville said in 2009, quote, taking the evidence as to the tuft fiber and the DNA and the bite mark evidence, the court finds that the entire prosecution case has now been undermined, and that Bill has established his burden of proof to show that the evidence before me points unerringly to innocence. But the DA appealed that decision, and the California Court of Appeal reversed it. That reversal was then upheld by the California Supreme Court, a decision that was called the worst decision of the year by the California Lawyer magazine. It said that experts could not recant their testimonies based on the fact that they were only an opinion. CIP then worked to introduce a new bill that would change this. And once that new law was enacted in California, the Supreme Court again heard Bill's case and reversed his conviction on May 26, 2016.
By the time I walked out the door, it was funny because it was a feeling of normalcy. You know, a lot of people describe other things. It's like, I didn't belong in there. And I never let my mind think that I belonged in there. My mind was always, no, I'm a real civilian, I'm outside. And so when I walked out the door, it was just like, okay, things are normal again. Things are back. Of course, they'll never be normal again. But I'll never be whole again, and I'll never have my family back. But I just felt like this is where I'm supposed to be. And it just felt like a pressure off my shoulders, you know.
So if we can talk now about your freedom, do you mind talking about your health? Or
No problem.
It's so that's something that I find really hard to take when reading your cases. You know, you've been handed so much shit, and then get this other bombshell.
Yeah, well, it was 2007 that I finally found out that a test in early 2003 showed cancer. And so I finally, with considerable fighting from CIP and their attorneys, finally got some treatment. That ended in January 2008. And so, of course, I thought it was done, you know, because it's an easy cancer to cure if you get it early. Of course, at that time, I didn't know that it had been, I didn't know that it had been detected in 2003. It's not till going back to the records and finding that. But then turned around and it just kept coming back. And it took years of fighting again to get another autopsy. And when I did get the autopsy, it showed cancer cells. So we went back and did a very destructive procedure where the first one was radiation. It was very pinpoint, like a sniper. The other one was like a shotgun. It just kind of wiped out a lot of damage. And then it wasn't until I got on the street due to timing that start to find out it's not curable anymore. That they figure that the oncologists believe it moved in that years between 2003 and 2007. So by the time I started any of the treatment, it was too late, you know. And so now I've got to accept it is what it is. I've got to live my life to the fullest.
So you were handed back your freedom, and then you had this other.
Yes. Yeah, I had another. Yeah, it's like closing another door on you. You know, you come out and you think you're going to have all this life ahead of you and you're going to enjoy it and go on and build a new future, and then you find out you don't have a future. So, which is why I'm traveling so much. I'm trying to get as much living in as I can. There's a TV show when I was a kid that, of course, you would never know. It was called Run for Your Life. And it was about a guy who had a terminal illness. He was going to die in a year. And he ran. He did everything. He did the things I'm doing, you know. So I'm just, I don't have family. I don't have anyone to take care of, you know. So I'm just going to go for the most I can. I've already got a will and leaving considerable amount to CIP and other people. So when these civil actions and stuff come through, most of the money will go to charities. It's all charities that the money's left to. I'm doing everything I can on very limited resources. The European trip was awesome. It went on for about 6 weeks. How many people get to ride a motorcycle through the Alps or through the Italy mountains and how many people just get to do this stuff, go take a picture on the Glockner Pass on the motorcycle you just rode up there. They give you a patch for riding up there, you know. And then I'm going to go to the Far East here soon. And then I'm probably pretty much stuck until I can get some more resources. But can you
tell me about looking at those mountains at the Alps and just being kind of stood or riding your bike through them and comparing that to being in a prison cell?
Oh, God, they're two different worlds. They're completely. I used to say being in prison was like being dropped on a hostile alien planet, because people spoke the same language, but it was somewhat, you know, there's a lot of things in there. It took me a while to catch on what they were saying, but it's a totally hostile, vile place. And here you are in all this freedom. You can see for miles, you can see glaciers, you're winding around twisty mountain roads on a high-tech motorcycle. I mean, there's just no comparison between the two. One is life, and one is less than life. I try hard to put it behind, but it always comes up. It always comes up. I'll be looking at something like this, and I'll flash back to being locked in a concrete cage. You can't get away from that. That'll always come back at you. And it kind of sometimes makes you think about the time you lost. That's a long time. So they always say that you lost, like in my case, they say 23 years. That's not true. I lost my whole life. Because everything I was, accomplished, and had done, people I'd loved before that, they're all gone. So now it's like I'm being dropped on another alien planet, you know, because the world has changed so much. People still speak the same language, but nothing else is the same. Nothing is the same as what I left. But this is heaven. It can't get any better than this for a guy that's been locked up like that.
Hey, I'm Jeremy Stock, staff attorney fellow at California Innocence Project. I see letters every single day from incarcerated individuals claiming innocence. The work it takes to find the strong cases for innocence is not possible without your support. Please visit CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org to see how you can get involved.
All right. All right, man. Yeah. I'll see you around.
This podcast was produced by me, Callum McRae. Please rate and leave feedback for us on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts.